The following is an encore episode of Convergence with Michelle McAloon and Ellen Taylor. On this episode, Ellen and Michelle talk with Dr. Andrew Mikta about where things stand with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and how it's affecting the United States. We hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Convergence. I am Ellen Taylor, and we talk about issues of faith, culture, and where it all intersects. I'm here with my good friend, Michelle McAloon. How are you today, Michelle?
I'm good. I'm doing well, Ellen. Actually, I'm not that far away from you in the midst of a semi-tropical storm on Dolphin Island.
See, look at you. You're over on Dolphin Island. I'm over in Fairhope. We're living the life here in Lower Alabama. But we talk about things around our local sphere and in many cases around the world. And for that, we're bringing in a guest today. We're speaking today with Dr. Andrew Mikta. He is the Dean of the College of International and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Germany. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great. And of course, you got to say a disclaimer. You're joining us here to talk about some issues, but in the context of your opinions, right?
Yes, correct. I want to make sure that my comments here are in my private capacity. As an analyst, they do not represent the official position or policy of the Marshall Center, the Defense Department, or the U.S. government. I'm speaking here as a scholar, period.
Oh, good. Well, we like scholarly opinions, too, because there's a lot to unpack in the world today. And I guess this being just passing the six-month anniversary of the situation in Ukraine that's been going on there with the conflict, and I think a lot of us had high hopes that this would end shortly after it started, yet it seems to be going on. And we're hoping you can give us a little perspective on this, on why maybe as an American sitting here, we feel like, oh, can't we just get this done? But there's a lot more to it than that, right?
Yes.
Right. And Ellen, yeah, and his article on global disbelief in the Wall Street Journal, which was an excellent article. And Andrew, that's what we hope you speak to.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you again. You know, it just struck me yesterday was literally 6 months to a date when that war started. And it was also the national holiday of Ukraine, the Independence Day. So the 24th of August was a very important day for the Ukrainians. And there's several things that I think we need to unpack here. One is what the initial expectations were, you know, that this would be a repeat of 2014. You recall the Russians seized Crimea. They invaded parts of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. And that the Ukrainian military would somehow underperform again, and that the Ukrainians will be disunited in their response. Well, the reason we are where we are is largely because of the Ukrainian people. I mean, their resilience, their patriotism, their determination to fight for their freedom and their sovereignty, and of course the leadership of President Zelensky, who surprised everyone. I mean, if I were to identify real leaders who come up, you know, who rise up in the crisis, there is something Churchillian about Zelensky when I watch him. The other side of the coin is what I call the collective disbelief among the key European countries. Well, first of all, this was not supposed to happen. I mean, in the post-Cold War Europe, you were not supposed to have traditional state-on-state war, territorial gains, destroying cities, killing civilians. I mean, in this postmodern Europe, this was not supposed to happen. The second point is the extent to which the last 20 years of energy policy in Europe has made most of the EU and especially Germany dependent on Russian energy. I mean, I'll give you a data point here. In 2014, Germany was about 35% dependent on Russian gas. Today, that dependence has doubled. And Germany has two remaining nuclear reactors that it is still considering, you know, shutting down as part of their so-called Energiewende, the move away from nuclear power, away from fossil fuels and to renewables. So we're looking at a ripple effect all across Europe because of what has happened. My sense is that as I sit here in Germany and I kind of listen to the policy discussions and attend different conferences, with both government officials and think tankers and politicos, that there's that sense of unwillingness or inability to accept how fundamentally European security has already changed. And it's both where the center of gravity in Europe is. Remember, this is a post-Brexit Europe, so the Brits are really, this is a much more continental and quote-unquote German European Union in terms of the relative power distribution. The Brits were the second largest economy in the EU before they departed. And also the level of insecurity that you see in Europe. Remember, Europe has effectively disarmed over the last 30 years. The defense spending is nowhere near where it needs to be. And it's not just the spending numbers. It's Europe not having real usable military capabilities. And suddenly this war happens. And had it not been for the U.S. leadership and the leadership of the countries along the flank, you know, the small Baltic states, Poland, Romania, you know, even the Scandinavians who decided to step up, join the NATO alliance, you know, the Finns and the Swedes ending their tradition of neutrality. That flank response and American leadership here is in a very stark contrast to the kind of uncertainty and timidity even that is still prevalent in the rest of Europe.
Dr. Mikta, what has caused this disbelief?
I think a lot of it has to do with what happened in 1990 and 1991, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the unification of Germany, the fact that Germany is no longer a frontier state. Remember, the Germans during the Cold War were in the most dangerous area of Europe. They were the front line. I mean, if a war between the Warsaw Pact and NATO were to happen, Germany would have been probably reduced to ashes. So they lived in this environment where hard security was always paramount. The Bundeswehr was the critical element of NATO defenses when it comes to conventional deterrence. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of soldiers, tanks, airplanes, the U.S. nuclear deterrent, U.S. military footprint here, which was orders of magnitude greater than what we have today. So all of that has kind of become phased out. Instead, all of a sudden with NATO enlargement to the east, with EU enlargement, Germany is no longer a frontier state. It's got other states that are facing Russia on the eastern flank. And there was the expectation that in this globalized postmodern era, it was all about interdependence in trade. There's an expression I heard in Germany quite often, Wandel durch Handel, change through trade, that by trading with Russia, you would manage that relationship through political and economic means. And that complex interdependence, as the political scientists like to call it, would then create a situation where war would simply be irrational and unviable and too destructive in terms of economic flows, trade, and finance. Of course, I always considered that to be lunacy. If you look at Europe before the First World War, there was a lot of dependence at that time as well. And what, instead of creating interdependence, it created dependence, especially in the realm of Russian energy. I think it takes leadership to take the new reality down to the level of dinner table conversations. I was in a debate recently with Barry Posen from MIT on this. And his argument was, well, if the Europeans, if we felt there was our national interest at play, we would have been full bore in it. The Europeans would have been full bore in it. Well, that's what people thought in 1938. You know, in 1938, the leaders were not telling them the gravity of the situation. Instead, they were trying to find a way to appease through diplomatic means. That was, you know, Chamberlain with his peace in our time and try again. A year later, they were in a war. And it took the Churchillian leadership to articulate the gravity of the situation. So one of the reasons I think why Europe is in this state of disbelief outside of the eastern flank, I repeat that, because if you look at what the countries like Poland are doing or the Baltic states, and relative to their size and their economic performance and their GDP, they're sending aid to Ukraine that is orders of magnitude greater than anything the Western Europeans have been doing in terms of just the sheer volume of equipment and providing the logistical transshipping points and whatnot. Why do they do this? Because they know, having been, you know, previously within the Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire, what is at stake. To them, war is truly existential. a lost war means for a country like Latvia or Estonia means that you're probably losing your sovereignty and you're losing your independence and you're becoming once again dominated by the Russian power. That sense doesn't exist, I think, in most of Western Europe. There is what I call regionalization of security optics in Europe. If you're close to the flank, you are focused on Russia. As you start moving farther west, you know, that sense of urgency becomes less. And then if you look at national priorities, the French are oriented very much towards the Mediterranean and Africa. You know, so to them, what's happening in Central and Eastern Europe is probably secondary to what's happening, you know, deep in the Sahel and other areas. So that sense of, yes, NATO is politically unified. There's a sense of political unity in statements, but there's a very different level of appetite for risk-taking as you travel from east to west across the European continent.
You have some perspective here, Doctor, that I think we don't get much in the States in regards to the everyday folk. And just when you were painting that picture of as you move west, people are less inclined to want to be engaged, nor have it on the radar. I think once you, from Europe, you cross the Atlantic Ocean to the U.S., that is even more compounded by our distance and our other domestic issues that are up on the radar here. And I think, Michelle, going back to one point where you said, you know, this has always been Europe. But when we fought World War II, and this is just from the domestic American perspective here, so I don't have any military knowledge like you two, we were promised this is the war to end all wars. We are going to learn how to get along with people. So where did we go wrong? Is it unserious politicians that have got us to this point again? Is it poor diplomatic relationships? Fundamentally, Michelle and I have talked about this off the show, the Russian sphere, they think very differently than we do in the Western sphere. But we once again are ratcheting ourselves up to a situation that could be catastrophic, just as it was in the 20th century, yet we don't seem to be learning from it, and we don't seem to be able to have an exit ramp from the situation now. And so what do we say to that? How do we address that?
I completely agree with you that sometimes what's going on here in Europe and the war in Ukraine registers at home as somewhat peripheral, you know, and especially when people are looking at the rising energy costs, you know, we've been traveling through a very strange and unusual period in world history when you think of where we were in 2019 before the epidemic started, the COVID pandemic started. Then you have, you had the COVID pandemic, you've got the kind of massive injections of equity into both the European and American economies. You've got the inflationary pressures that this creates. You've got the energy issues, and now you have a war. So it seems like the public is not keeping up with how radically things are changing, and there is a desire because of the pressures, I think, at home. And it's also true about Western Europe, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans are looking at a very cold winter potentially. And I would be curious to know how the German or the French public opinion will react, while at the same time the Hungarians are cutting deals with Putin to buy gas, probably at very favorable rates. You know, so the sense of European solidarity is already creaking and groaning here. I think it's very hard to keep democracies focused and mobilized on such issues without our respective governments making very clear cases of what's at stake here. I mean, let's remember what Putin is trying to do in Europe. If you look at what he demanded before he invaded Ukraine, he is basically demanding a sphere of influence in that space which used to be post-Soviet. He wants NATO to go back to the pre-1998 status quo. He wants U.S. troops out of Central Europe. He wants a special relationship with Germany, the kind of quasi-Bismarckian deal, you know, whereby Germany, you know, and as the biggest economy and dependent on Russian gas, allows the Russians to have oversized influence on European politics. So this is a wholesale redefinition of the security architecture that has been in place, not just since the end of the Cold War, but quite frankly, since 1945. The fact that the U.S. security is anchored both in the Atlantic and in the Pacific. And so you hear a lot of the voices, and another voice you hear in the United States is, why Europe when we should be focusing on China? That's the kind of either-or proposition,
right?
That a lot of commentators are making. My answer to this is the Chinese and the Russians have created a two-frontier crisis for us, okay? What the Ukrainians are doing right now, they're in effect dismantling that because they're grinding down the Russian military at a horrendous expense. Both to themselves, to their population, to their country. I mean, the Russians are using long-range artillery and rockets to literally grind down Ukrainian cities into dust. And the losses that we're estimating, the cost of potential reconstructions, I sat recently on an EU roundtable of a group called United for Ukraine, where people are looking at these estimates. We're looking at $1 trillion already at this level of destruction. And this is going to grow exponentially. So it's what's happening in Ukraine has been a huge miscalculation by Putin, in my view. He was probably lied to by his own generals and his own intelligence officials, you know, who are expecting a very quick overthrow of the Zelensky government and then a parade, you know, in Kiev and a puppet regime put in place. But that is dramatically changing the relative power distribution in the world. I'm sure the Chinese are watching this very carefully. If the Ukrainian military can fight back like this against the Russians, you know, would it be as easy as they thought to take over Taiwan, where the army is much better equipped, and trained and whatnot? So this is the ripple effects of this war are going to reverberate across the entire global security architecture. And I think what we are missing is, and again, I'm returning here to Europe, but I'm sure it applies also in the United States, this larger strategic picture that needs to be communicated directly to the public, I think, that is missing in the conversation right now. What is really at stake? What Putin's victory in Ukraine would mean? It would be a civilizational transformation, in my view, of how European politics have been conducted and how they would be conducted going forward. And my kind of closing comment to this segment, I would say, look, any sort of status quo ceasefire in place is a win for the Russians, for Putin. He has taken about 20% of Ukrainian territory. He controls, for the most part, the entire industrial eastern sector. And if he can block Ukrainian access to the Black Sea, Ukraine cannot export grain, cannot export its agricultural output. It becomes, in effect, a kind of Moldova on a larger scale, a failed state with very, very little resources to sustain itself and probably a kind of source of perennial instability on NATO eastern flank. I think if we were to enter into some sort of a deal like the Minsk agreement that we had in 2014, and just try to freeze the conflict, we would be handing the Russians a victory.
Andrew, what you said was key, in especially when we are speaking about U.S. current U.S. leadership, and I don't care, it's on both sides of the houses. This is not being articulated to the American public on a whole scale way. It may be in the branches of academia to some degree, but I, at this juncture, I believe most Americans don't see the critical situation that if we're not in immediately, we could be in if we are not dedicated to keeping democracy within Europe.
Well, I think to your point there, Michelle, I think a lot of Americans have seen it and they just are not buying into it. They don't see it as a top concern. Yes, it's a percolating issue, but it's Dr. Mitka, saying it's a lack of understanding of how what a crisis level it is to particular areas geographically over in the arena where this war is happening. It's that Americans have other issues on their plate and they have seen it. And not to say that it's not important, but is that more important to the guy who can't pay his gas bill or his food bill or do both this week? Like, all things are local. So I think you're trying to present a big picture, which is great. We need to have that big understanding, but people live in the particulars, in the granular. And so I think it's really hard sell to the American public on that perspective right now, until such a point that it escalates and it will be in their face, so to speak. And I think that's human nature.
Yeah, I think you've got a very valid point here. You know, there's several things that play a role here, I think. One is the day-to-day concerns, and we're going through some pretty tough economic times back home and, quite frankly, here in Europe as well, in part because of the kind of inflationary pressures that you see, the cost of energy. I mean, Putin is playing with the gas market in Europe, for example, by fluctuating it. Right now, Nord Stream 1, which is the under the Baltic Sea pipe that feeds gas directly into Germany from Russia, that is running at about 20% capacity. And most of the observers expect him to cut off gas completely to Europe come fall and winter, to create instability, dislocations, and whatnot. And this is not just a question of energy. Gas is needed for European industry and the rest of it. So I agree with you. The problem that I'm having with people saying, well, this is just happening out there and over there. This is the region where two world wars originated. I mean, this crush zone of Europe, Eastern European flank. The First World War, the Second World War, quite frankly, the Cold War did not escalate to an all-out kinetic conflict, but it was in effect over the same set of issues, over who will control the resources of Eurasia and Europe. And we committed for the duration to essentially prevent the Soviets from overrunning Europe after 1945, which probably was not outside the realm of the possible. I'm not saying that history repeats itself, you know, that the kind of over-rationalizing history is a little too simplistic, but I would argue that history rhymes on occasion. And one of those occasions when history tends to rhyme. What we're looking at is the alliance, in effect, between the Chinese and the Russians. So this is one problem set. You know, most of the scholars were saying Asia first, Asia really matters. We shouldn't be taking our eyes off of where things are really happening. The Russians and the Chinese are aligned in their opposition to the United States and to the Western democratic system that we have put in place, or we tried to put in place more or less successfully since 1945 and especially after 1990. So this is not just a geopolitical challenge, it's also an ideological challenge. You know, and like when we look at China, we see the economic problem set, we see the military problem set, but we also see an ideological problem set. The Chinese are selling their own version of state capitalism, quite frankly. I called it in one of my articles I wrote some time ago, a free market for unfree people. You do what the Communist Party tells you to do, and that state mercantilist capitalism will provide you, you know, with a better standard of living, et cetera, et cetera. Why is this important? Because during the Cold War, everybody in Eastern Europe knew if you were free, you were prosperous. If you were a liberal democracy, you know, if you're a democracy, you lived well because the market systems worked and all of that. The Europeans are nowhere near that kind of understanding of where China is heading. And I think because we are having resource constraints and we've been spending inordinate amounts of money, in part because of the crisis, because of the dislocation caused by COVID, the energy pressures, the inflation pressures that we have, all of that is creating that sense that this is somehow not our business, that this is somehow happening out there. Now, I think that's a very nearsighted view that we're taking. You said it yourself, that until it hits home, until it pulls us directly into it. Well, let's imagine that Ukraine fails, right? That it fails to defend its sovereignty. Putin is not going to stop. He will reconstitute his military, and in two years or more, he will move forward. He will try to absorb all of Ukraine, and then possibly, will make a decision to breach the NATO flank itself. And that changes the entire situation in Europe, and that it's not just a question of Article 5 commitments and NATO and all of that, but just the implications of this would be just impossible for us to ignore. And I think we would be pulled into a much wider conflict.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's a pay now or pay later situation.
Right.
When you look at this, and it's how much imagination does, and you know what, maybe the guy at the gas pump can't see this, but our leadership needs to have the strategic imagination and awareness of the danger of what this could pose for the United States. And guess what? That's called political leadership at this point.
Let me ask you too, are there any authentic third parties that could come in and speak to peace as we have in the past sometimes? Are there any players like that that can be an authentic third party voice for de-escalation?
I don't think at this point, and here's why. What we're dealing with is essentially the most naked exercise of military power that we have seen since the end of the Cold War or the end of the Second World War. I mean, we're looking right now at a kind of grind that looks like a war of attrition. This is a wood chipper that's eating up both the Ukrainian and the Russian forces, although the Ukrainians are doing much better now that they've received Western weapons, which are much more effective, much more accurate, much more sophisticated than anything that the Russians can field. Turkey is trying to play a role of some sort of a broker in this. You know, Erdogan brokered the deal on being able to ship some of the grain out of Ukraine. But Erdogan is playing his own game. The Turks want to become the kind of dominant regional power. The Germans and the French, I think it's been clear that they, from the start, wanted to bring about some sort of a cessation of hostilities, if you will. Most of all, I don't think Putin is interested in this. As long as this grind continues and he is gaining territory at whatever cost, remember, he has not declared general mobilization. He is not mobilizing people in major European cities of Russia, because that would impact the Russian middle class, and that could be quite dangerous for him politically. He's going to the Far East. He's recruiting in prisons. He's bringing people who probably are not in the category of people who would define the domestic situation in Russia going forward. So I don't think we have much space here for any sort of negotiated solution at this point. And I think the real game changer would be the political impact of a Ukrainian victory on a battlefield. If Ukraine survives as a sovereign state, I have no doubt that the regime of Lukashenko in Belarus will implode. It's just a matter of time. Putin cannot tolerate another Eastern Slavic country to become a sovereign, democratic, and successful polity right next to his own, you know, kleptocratic state, and right next to Lukashenko. And that would confront the Russians with the imperative of figuring out what it means to be a normal Russian state, quote unquote, in this geostrategic environment, you know, in the middle of the 21st century. And I think he's desperate not to have to ask that question, because that means the end of the kind of kleptocratic, corrupt regime that is today's Russia.
We've got a lot of complicated issues going on in the world, sadly, more than we can fit into this show. So we're going to leave the conversation here. Thank you for joining the show today, Dr. Andrew Mikta. You can see his opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal and check out more thoughts he has on it. For Michelle McAloon, I'm Ellen Taylor. Thanks for listening to Convergence.